Okay, here goes.
They're two separate handouts. So if everybody can get one of each, I hope there'll be enough for everybody, but I wasn't sure exactly how many people to expect. So people may have to look on together. What you have coming around is a set of actual sources in Hebrew with English translation, and then a newspaper article. And we'll start with that. We'll just spend the first few minutes on current events before we get into some actual sources from the Middle Ages. Okay. If there aren't enough, if people don't mind looking on together, I apologize. If you don't have the article, you probably won't miss out too much. The Hebrew sources are probably more important. I mean, you know, in my opinion, but... Okay, so I thought maybe we could start with a brief thought experiment. And it's going to be a little bit, I don't want to say controversial, but maybe call for a visceral response. And the thought experiment is as follows. If you could find out, if you found out one day that the end of the world was at hand, that within the next few days, maybe weeks, everything that you see around you would come to an end, and that you would be taken up to heaven to eternal reward, eternal bliss, the life of Olam Haba, that I guess we all in our own ways work towards, and you knew that that was coming, and you were assured that you yourself would be heading there. But you found out that your family members, your kids, your parents, maybe your spouse, siblings, would not be coming along for the ride. And that they would be not only not getting the reward and the bliss that you're going to be getting, but they're going to be suffering on earth for a circumscribed period of time, real serious suffering. And that afterwards they're going to go not to the life of the world to come, well, the life of a world to come, but not the one that we aspire to. They're going to be going to Gehinnom, to hell, where they'll suffer for all of eternity. So how'd you feel? I sometimes tell my students in class there's no wrong answer, but maybe there's a wrong answer here. I'm not sure. Hopefully by the end of today we'll have figured it out. How would you feel? Okay, there you go. So if we can't, I think the tension here is undeniable, right? On the one hand, this is what all of us as Jews, as religious people, work towards. At the same time, our familial relations are sort of, that's for many of us, the most important thing that we have, certainly one of the most important things we have in this world. How would we feel? Let's keep that question in the back of our minds. Now, this is not only a thought experiment, because we actually can test this experimentally based on current events, and that's the newspaper article that you have in front of you. As some of you may know, last month in May, there was an idea floating around among certain communities of evangelical Christians that the world would be coming to an end on May 21st, and the people who held to this belief actually were encountered with this dilemma that I just posed to you. They believed that they would be assumed bodily into heaven, that they would, at the return of their Lord and Savior, they would... sort of get these rewards that they've been working towards. But they believe that their family members who were not believers, who didn't accept that the end was coming, would be going to another place. How would they feel? So here we can test this. So if this is halacha l'maaseh for them, right? This is actually happening, or they believed it was happening. We found out, all of us, that it didn't actually end up happening that way. How did they feel? So if you look at the article that you have in front of you, you find a sort of array of responses, but I would say not the array of responses that we might expect, because the predominant sentiment, if you look through this article, is that, you know, it's really a shame what's going to happen to my kids and, you know, my wife and my parents, but I really can't wait for the Lord to come back, right? There's definitely an emphasis on looking out for number one, right? Now, what kind of a conception of family does that response imply? If your first reaction to this kind of a sort of a dilemma, right, the classic example of mixed feelings is, well, my feelings actually aren't really that mixed, right? I'm going to veer all the way towards what's going to be good for me, which is my own spiritual edification, my own reward in the world to come, and whatever happens to people on earth, well, you know, that's their business. They should have gone to church more often. What does it tell us about the way that these people perceive of the spiritual and theological meaning of family? Please.
It seemed like very self-centered from this family. It's, oh, well, they just stopped saving for college and working on that. So let's neglect all the kids and
right.
our responsibilities toward them because that one's going to be okay.
Yeah, exactly, right? There's, if we're looking through for choice quotes here, right, so somebody on page 3 says, you know, I have mixed feelings here. I'm very excited about the Lord's return, but I'm fearful that my children will get left behind, right? And remember, if you get left behind in this conception, it's not just you don't go to heaven. Really, 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 really bad things happen to you. But, you know, you have to accept God's will. So it is a certain, I think our initial sentiment for many of us probably is to see this as kind of a selfish reaction, to see this as being out of keeping with kinds of values that probably many of us instinctively feel, right? The visceral response, at least for me in reading this, was, these are dreadful people. How can you possibly have this kind of a response to the news that the most important people in your lives are going to be suffering, real, serious, eternal suffering?
Were there any interviews with these kids afterwards?
You know, I looked for articles. I haven't found any, but I think it would make a fascinating study, a psychological study maybe, or right? There's work still to be done here. And I think that our instincts would not just be personally to see this as being something off-putting, but for many of us, I think we would see this as being fundamentally out of keeping with what Judaism has to say about family, right? And this is the direction that I'm heading in, because when we think about Judaism, many of us, certainly society as a whole, we tend to think about Judaism is all about the family, right? And sociologically, I think that certainly is true. We can find data that shows that people who have close familial relations with other people who are practicing Jews have a stronger level of religious identification. We can see that the kinds of activities that people engage in religiously are the ones that revolve around family, right? From a sociological perspective, it's undeniable that Judaism and family go hand in hand. And this isn't just true of Judaism, right? This is true of religion, I think, in the 21st century in general. The family that prays together stays together. Anybody heard this slogan before? Right? This notion that religion is going to be good for your family dynamic. Today, we tend to think about, when we want to say religious values, we say family values, right? Even in political discourse. Family values means values that are held to by religious people oftentimes. So this connection is really a tightly linked one. And yet ever so often, we find these kinds of outliers where the tension comes to a head and where people are choosing not the family part, but the individual religion part. Now, as I said, I think from a Jewish perspective, we would tend to find this repellent. And yet, when we look within the Jewish tradition, we find that the sources are absolutely not unanimous with regards to what is the value of family from a theological perspective. And it's that tension that I wanted to explore today for a little bit of time. And I want to look at that tension in a specific historical context, which is the period that I work on in my professional life, medieval Ashkenaz, 12th, 13th century Jewish communities in northern France and in Germany. Right, the big name, the Rashi, Balei HaTosfot, Rabbeinu Gershom or Agola. We all know probably some of the important names from this time period. We'll be looking at some of those sources and also some lesser known sources. And what I hope to show you is that this question about what is the theological value of family was one that was exploding during this time period and that people really found to be a compelling question that they needed to grapple with. And we'll, by the end, hopefully have some ideas about why that might have been and what kinds of lessons we can draw for our own perspectives on both Judaism and family in the 21st century. So this is where we're headed. Now, if you look at the sources in front of you, you'll see that already in Tanakh, and already in the works of Chazal in rabbinic literature, this notion that there is a potential tension between familial relations and what's going to happen to you, right, on a sort of a reward and punishment, life in the next world, from that perspective, the tension comes out already in some of these sources. And we'll just look at two very quick examples. If I can find my sources here. So, famously, there are two psukim in Tanakh that contradict each other in what seems to be an extremely blatant way. Right? On the one hand, source number one from the Sefer Devarim, Lo yumtu avot al banim, banim lo yumtu al avot, ish bechet o yumatu. An individualistic perspective. Nobody is punished for the sins of their parents. Right? Familial relations end where reward and punishment begins. At the same time, all we have to do is look in Shemot and see what seems to be the polar opposite perspective. And in the Yud Gimel Nido Tarachamim, the 13 descriptions of God's attributes, we read, among others, Poked Avon Avot Al Banim, Al Ve'albanei Banim, Al Shalishim Ve'al Ribeim, that one of Hashem's midot, one of Hashem's attributes, is that he does actually draw these connections among generations, such that it's very possible that you'll be punished for the sins of your father or grandfather or grandmother or great-grandmother till four generations. Blatant contradiction. What do we do with this? Does reward and punishment and family, do they intersect or not? So Chazal, as recorded in one, at least one famous passage in the Gemara, try to reconcile this, but in doing so, they veer absolutely towards the individualistic perspective. We can read source 1b. So the Gemara says, "Ubanim ba'avon avot lo." Is it really true that children are not punished for the sins of their parents, as the Gemara had previously said? V'haktiv, pokeid avon avot al banim. The pasuk we just read in Sefer Shemot. This is the way it works. If your parents sin, your children will be punished. So the Gemara says, "Hatam kishat ochsin b'maaseh avotam b'yadeihem." That's only the case when the children in question have inherited not some theologically abstract notion of familial guilt, but the actual concrete behaviors that they learned firsthand from their parents. That's when they're going to be punished for their parents' sins, because they've come to embody those sins personally. But is it possible, according to this perspective, that a tzaddik ben rasha, for example, right, which is a language that Gemara uses elsewhere, somebody who's a righteous person who happens to have come from a family of wicked people, that they'll be punished on behalf of the sins of their wicked ancestors? Impossible. Absolutely not. If we look elsewhere in the Gemara, source 2, we find that the conception of what the world to come itself will look like, I think, fits in very nicely with this perspective that I'm trying to chart for you. We won't read this inside, just in the interest of time, but in source 2, we're told what is the world to come actually consists of. If you do everything you're supposed to do and you're rewarded, right, you get the schar in the next world, you go to heaven, you go to Shemayim, whatever it might be, what does it look like? People are sitting, they're basking in the glow of God's glory, and that's pretty much it. No bodies, no eating, no drinking, no emotions, right? Everything is sort of hunky-dory, but the kinds of physical elements of life in this world that we're all accustomed to, they all fall away. And it's easy to understand why, in this depiction, for example, it doesn't say anything about whether you're going to see your parents in the world to come. It doesn't say anything about whether you're going to see your deceased relatives from previous generations in the world to come. Maybe we can find other sources that are going to talk about that, but in this source, that doesn't play in, and it has to do with this notion that reward in the next world is highly individualistic. Your familial relations are not going to play an impact on the way that you are rewarded in the next world. Now, that notion that there's an individualistic accounting that each person is going to experience, which will be not impacted by their web of familial relations, right? That is, that family, when it comes to theology of what happens to you after this life, is not going to play a significant role. That perspective is highlighted, and I would say taken to a really extreme direction, in a set of sources that we'll look at now from medieval Ashkenaz. And I'll just say a word or two about some of the sources we'll look at. In particular, we're going to be looking at a text called Sefer Chasidim, or the Book of the Pious, maybe a lesser-known text from this time period, written by the school and students of Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, who died in 1217, right? So late 12th and early 13th century in Ashkenaz. He lived in Germany. And he and his school, in this work and in others, seem to be positively obsessed with this question of what happens to your family in the world to come. Do you suffer for your parents' sins or not? Do you have any kinds of connections to your children or to your siblings once you move on to the next world? And we'll look at just a couple of examples here. Source 3 is actually from a contemporary of Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, who we won't go into detail now, but they have a very interesting relationship. Rabbi Moshe Taku, who wrote a book called Sefer K'tav Tamim that outlines some of his theological perspectives on an array of issues. And he says the following in his description of what happens at the resurrection of the dead, right? In the scheme of reward in after one's death that Judaism lays out, one central element is that the dead will be resurrected and they'll live once again on earth. And that they'll have, whether they'll live forever or not, is a question that different sort of authorities differ on. But there's clearly this notion that if you do what you're supposed to do, you will be resurrected and you'll live again. And Rabbi Moshe Taku says, well, what happens when you are resurrected? Do you relive the life that you lived previously? Are you going to still be married to the same woman? Will your kids still live in the house with you? Right? Are you still going to be a part of the same community? And in regards to the specific question of what's going to happen to these marriages, he says, and I'll read here from the Hebrew, "V'atzadikim yikru kol echad nashim lefi ma'asav," that at the time of the resurrection, righteous people will take new wives, "ki kol echad lo yisa et ishto shehayta lo ba'olam hazeh," Yim lo sheyihyu shavim besidkatam, that unless they're exactly identical in their level of righteousness, spouses are not going to remain spouses in the world to come, right? Because people are only going to be marrying people who are on their exact spiritual level, on their exact spiritual wavelength. Aval tzadik amor velo tzadik mura, o tzadik mura velo tzadik amor, right? A less than a total righteous person who was married to a woman who was completely righteous, or vice versa. Lo yitchaveru yachad latid, they will not be connected. Ki kishemetu nitparda chavila. Here's the key line here. When they die, their bonds are broken, right? Their connections are severed. After one passes away, you start over with a clean slate. And the result is that your family relations in this world are not going to transfer over into the next world. Now, some of the implications of that are extremely radical, and we'll go through some of them now. In Sefer Chassidim, the work that I mentioned, we read an array of consequences that sort of derive logically from this position that death severs all bonds. What are some of those perspectives? So let's start with source number 4. This is from Sefer Chassidim. We read there that at the resurrection, in the world to come, which is referred to here as the Garden of Eden, right? This notion that the world to come is going to be similar to this idyllic paradise that Adam and Eve originally lived in. In the Garden of Eden, Eliyahu Hanavi, who is often associated in some of these sources with what happens to you after you die, Eliyahu Hanavi is going to keep parents and children segregated from one another unless they are similarly of the exact same spiritual stature, right? So you live your life the proper way, you are a completely pious person, you move on to the next world, your children maybe are less so, or maybe are more so, you're not going to see them there. And he gives actually a very interesting interpretation of the verse that probably many of us are familiar with, Veheshiv lev avot al banim velev banim al avotam, right? That Eliyahu Hanavi in the Nevi'im is dafka referred to as a person who will return fathers to children. He says that's only in a very, very circumscribed situation. In general, Eliyahu Hanavi is not Heshiv lev avot al banim, and is not Heshiv lev banim al avotam. It's a direct consequence of the line of thought that we just laid out in the previous source. If we move to source... Yes, please.
Okay, so
mm-hmm.
Those are not the same thing.
Good.
So.
Absolutely. So in the interest of, if we had more time, we could lay out for these thinkers and for other thinkers how they see these different stages as being related or not related. As you're pointing out, there's actually multiple strata of what happens at the end of time, right? There's Biyat HaMashiach, the Messianic Age. There's the resurrection of the dead. There's life in the world to come. In some sources, there's talk of a final judgment, where everybody's gathered together and judged once and for all and sent off to either heaven or hell. So we have a lot of different perspectives here. For our purposes, I'm conflating them together, and you're right to point out that I'm doing so. I think if we had more time, we could try to work through the different strata, but in terms of all of these being something that happens after one's life on Earth in its normal manner has ended, I think we can group them at least for their perspective that they all offer on family. And as you're pointing out, since we have in these sources both resurrection and the world to come, and both of those levels are being correlated with what happens to your family, I think it actually highlights the fact that for these thinkers, this tension between family and the end of time is so strong that they're looking to find out how it happens in each stage, not just in one or another. But thank you for pointing it out. It's a really important distinction. Any other questions before we move on? Okay, let's get through a few more sources. Source number 5, an even more radical perspective. If we take our line of thought to its logical conclusion, and we say, what's important is righteousness, that's what's going to be determinant of your theological status in the world to come. Family, maybe it'll correlate, maybe not. Then what happens in this world? Right? If we've found out that in the world to come, familial relations fall away, that they're not significant enough to last into the Olam Ha'emet, right? The world of truth, where things are really as they should be. Well, what about in this world? Is family even significant in this world? Well, we find in source number 5, and again, I can't overemphasize how radical this seems from the perspective of contemporary Judaism. Source number 5 tells us, really, there's no reason for parents to love their children unless they're righteous. What? It says here that, and we'll read this together just very briefly, it's the third line in the Hebrew. Sharei im adam ohev gufan shel zaro, kacha kelev ohev et gurav. It's instinctual. It's base. Really, you should only love righteous people, whether they're related to you or not. And the fact that you should love somebody just because they're your flesh and blood is an animal notion. Now, this, again, could not be less in keeping with the way that I and many of us tend to think of the Jewish perspective towards family. What would motivate these thinkers to lay out this perspective? If we go through some other sources, we won't go through all of them in detail now, but you'll find a very similar notion, to the extent that in source number 8, which you can take a look at when you're ready, we're told that parents shouldn't even kiss their children unless they're independently excited about having done a mitzvah or having learned something interesting in the Torah, right? That familial intimacy is so out of keeping with what they think Judaism has to offer that really you should only express physical emotion to your children if you're motivated by some other factor, right? Now, the last conclusion here that I want to lay out, and this is what's going to take us into the opposite perspective, which is being laid out, the polar opposite perspective, which is being laid out during this time period, is in source number 9. Source number 9, also from Sefer Chassidim, says, the last conclusion that we can draw from this line of thought that I've been charting for you is that when one passes away, right, if somebody, you know, God forbid, loses a family member, don't bother praying for them. Why? It's too late, right? Family relationships don't carry over into the next world. If they did what they were supposed to do, you don't have to worry about them. If they didn't, there's nothing you can do to help them anyway. This is, again, a very radical perspective, and this notion that intercessory prayer is something that is out of keeping with what really goes on in the next world is what brings us to the other perspective, because it's exactly during this time period, the same 12th, 13th century in northern Europe, in Ashkenaz, that intercessory prayer is not being derided, as it is in these texts, but is being highlighted and brought to the fore of the way that people conceive of a Jewish liturgy. And I'm thinking of one prayer in particular, probably the most famous one that we can all think of in terms of what Jews say when they're trying to pray on behalf of their deceased relatives. Okay, the other very famous prayer, Kaddish Yatom, right? Mourner's Kaddish, which we all recite if you lose a parent for 12 months, if you lose other family members for other periods of time. It's during this exact time period, really almost down to the year, that Sidurim from northern Ashkenaz are starting to reflect the fact that people should recite Kaddish on behalf of their deceased relatives, which is the exact opposite perspective. Why should you bother praying for your family members unless there's some connection that lasts beyond the grave? And we'll look at one story. We've been sort of skirting through a lot of sources, but I want to look at one now in a little bit more detail, which lays out where the ritual of Kaddish came from, and hopefully we can start to unpack some of its symbolism in order to give us a sense of why another school of thinkers didn't agree with those who we've laid out so far, that familial relations are only for this world, that they're only pragmatic and not spiritually resonant, but that in fact they saw it as being something that is at the core of who a person is, that one's family connections define them and carry over because they're the most important thing that one has. Let's look at this story. Do people prefer that we read this in Hebrew or English?
Either.
Either? I don't know what people's preferences are. All right, maybe I'll read this in Hebrew, but there's an English translation as well. It's at the bottom of the fourth page, source number 10.
Do you have a Nick?
I'm sorry, I don't.
Can you give it to Mama and have her Xerox? Have one copy?
If somebody wants to volunteer a copy, we can certainly make some more. Okay. Okay. I'm sorry to make you get up and... Okay, well, we'll read through this, and hopefully everybody will be back by the time we get to the punchline. Ma'aser Rabbi Akiva. This is a text in a book called Machzor Vitri, which is one of the most significant sidurim from Ashkenaz. It's associated with the school of Rashi. Rashi and his students compiled a book in the town of Vitri, right? Machzor Vitri. It's the Machzor of the town of Vitri, where they put together Minhag Ashkenaz as it relates to prayer. And for the first time in this collection, we find this notion that when somebody has a deceased relative, they ought to pray for them with the recitation of Kaddish. Kaddish, incidentally, had existed for a long time previously, right? If you've been to Shul lately, you know that Kaddish is recited at numerous stages during the liturgy, not always by mourners. In this time period, what's new is that specifically people who are orphans or who have lost family members are being told to recite it on behalf of their deceased relatives. And here's the story that Rashi and students tell about where this notion came from. Ma'asev Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was once walking, haya mahalech b'beit ha'kvarot baderech, upaga ba'adam echad shaya arum v'shachor kepecham V'haya ta'un mas'oi gadol shel kotzim al rosho. Rabbi Akiva was taking a leisurely stroll through the cemetery, and he encountered somebody who was black as coal, carrying a great burden of wood, and who had a pile of thorns over his head. Kasavur alav Rabbi Akiva shehu chai v'haya ratz kasus. Rabbi Akiva saw this man who was running like a horse, carrying this great burden, and he assumed he was alive, as probably many of us would assume if we encountered a person while we were walking. Gazar alav Rabbi Akiva v'hemido. So Rabbi Akiva made him stop. V'amar lo, ma le'oto ha'ish la'asot avodah kasha kazot. What's going on? Why are you carrying this great burden of wood and running like this? If you're a servant and you're being worked so hard, so I'll redeem you. And if you are poor and this is your only livelihood, well, I'll give you money and make sure that you don't have to do this anymore. Amar lo, bevakasha mincha al ta'akveni, shem yergazu bi hamunim alai. He says to him, leave me alone. People are going to get angry at me if I'm too delayed. Okay, Amar lo mazo ma ma'asecha. Rabbi Akiva says, so new still, what's going on here? Amar lo oto ha'ish mate. I'm dead. U'b'chol yom sholchim oti lachtov etzim, and I'm sent out every day to chop wood. Amar lo b'ni ma haya malachtecha be'olam shebata mimenu. Rabbi Akiva says to him, how did this come to be? What was your profession in the world that you came from? Amar lo gabai hameches hayiti. I was a tax collector. Right? Probably the way that many of us feel around April 15th. Vayiti noseh panim la'ashirim v'horeg et ha'aniyim. And I would favor the rich, and in doing so, I would kill the poor. Okay. Amar lo klum shamata me'otam hamemonim alacha leporanut ezo devar sheyesh lo takana. So Rabbi Akiva says to him, is there anything I can do to help you? Right? Surely there must be some way, even though you've committed these heinous sins, for me to redeem you from this horrible suffering. And he says, there's a back and forth. There's nothing you can do for me. Don't even bother. He says, no, really, I want to help you. The guy says, finally, you know, I heard this one impossible thing. Skip down a line or two. Ela shamata meham devar shelo haya yachol lehiot. I heard something impossible. That if only this guy had a son who would recite Kaddish for him, he would be redeemed immediately from his sufferings. But the guy says, I never even had a son. Really, when I died, my wife was pregnant, but I don't even know if she gave birth to a son or not. And even if she gave birth to a son, who would teach him how to daven? Who would teach him Torah? Who would teach him that he has to recite this prayer on my behalf? I have no hope. You may as well just leave me alone. Now, Rabbi Akiva, being Rabbi Akiva, decides that this is not something that he's willing to let stand. And he goes out and he seeks the man's son. He seeks his wife. He finds them. And if we go into the next paragraph, at the middle of the first line, so he says, Kevan shabalo tomakom. So once Rabbi Akiva made it to the man's town, sha'al alav, Amrulo yishachaku atzvotav shel oto ha'ish. That guy, his bones should rot. They really didn't like him. Sha'al al ishto, he asked after his wife. Amrulo yimchez zichra min ha'olam. May her memory be erased from the world. Amrulo, sha'al al beno. So finally he gets to the crux of the matter. He asks, where is the guy's son? He needs to teach him to recite Kaddish so that he'll redeem his father from suffering. Amrulo hare arelhu. That kid, he's uncircumcised. Afilu mitzvat mila lo isaknu bo. We didn't even bother to give him a bris mila. Right? You can imagine how heavy their disdain must have been. So miyad malo Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva immediately gave him a circumcision. Vehoshivo b'sefer lefanav v'lo haya mekabel ha-Torah ad sheyashav mem yom b'ta'anid. Rabbi Akiva then tries to teach him Torah, tries to teach him the kinds of prayers that he's going to need to recite in order to redeem his father. But something strange happens. The kid can't learn. He's incapable of absorbing the information that Rabbi Akiva is presenting before him. Until finally Rabbi Akiva fasts for 40 days, at which point Hashem speaks to him in a bat kol and says, in this heavenly voice, and says, for this you're fasting? Right? Even Hashem seems to be on the side of the townspeople. You're fasting for this poor kid? And Rabbi Akiva says, if we look in the middle of the paragraph here, Amar lefanav ribono shel olam, ve'alo lefanecha arachti oto. It's for you that I'm doing this. At that point, miyad patacha kadosh baruch hu et libo, v'limdo Torah, kriyat shema, birkat hamazon, etc. At that point, Hashem relents, and the kid is immediately able to begin to absorb the information that Rabbi Akiva is presenting before him. And finally, at the culmination of the story, the child recites Kaddish, and the father is immediately released from his sufferings, ascends to heaven, and everybody lives happily ever after. This is the story that Rashi and his school tell about where Kaddish came from. And again, this story is unique to the 12th century. So even though it's a story about Rabbi Akiva, right, we have many midrashim that are about Tanaim, and we know from on good authority that they need to be understood either metaphorically or they can't be taken as literal historical fact. The fact that this story is being told for the first time in the 12th century means that at the very least we need to look within it for symbols that would have been relevant to people in the 12th century. Now, for starters, right, the very notion that a prayer on behalf of the dead, which has the potential to alleviate their suffering, the fact that people start to recite that already tells us that the perspective that I charted out in the first half of this class, that family is irrelevant, that family has no impact on your soul, was not a unanimous perspective, right? That there must have been at least some measure of debate among different authorities during this time period as to what family really means. In this perspective, family is very important, clearly. But if we look between the lines of the story, we actually find that we can solve some of the strange details in the story, and I think get an even better sense of the familial theology that underlies it, by reading very carefully and looking for sort of little hints in the story as to what its authors might have intended. Let me start with a couple of questions. First of all, why might it be that in 12th century Northern Europe, the worst sin that Rashi and his school could think of is a tax collector? Right? We have a lot of stories in Chazal about wicked people. If you look at the way that Chazal described Esav, right? Esav is somebody who would rape women on Yom Kippur, I don't know, while eating a ham sandwich, right? Like the worst things you can possibly imagine. Tax collector's bad, right? But why is it that that sin in particular is chosen to be the exemplar of the worst kind of sinner, and even he can be redeemed from suffering? Please. Okay.
And it's very negative within the community to his people.
Definitely a possibility, right? If we think about what a community looked like in 12th century Ashkenaz, right? We have these autonomous or semi-autonomous corporate communities where Jews are almost entirely running their own affairs, with the exception of their responsibilities that they have towards their outside authorities, which is mainly in the form of taxation. And tax collectors, I think, throughout history probably don't have a very good rap. And yet... Right. So I wouldn't want to retroject that, you know, capo idea back onto this time period. But if we read that sort of between the lines, I think it's definitely a direction to think in, for sure. Question one, though, right? Let's keep this in the back of our mind. Why a tax collector? Question two. Why is it that the child in the story is unable to absorb any of the information that Rabbi Akiva teaches him? Right? This seems like an extraneous detail. We have a story about a child. The upshot of the story we all know is supposed to be the kid learns how to say Kaddish and he recites it and teaches us that Kaddish will redeem your parents from their suffering. Why do we add that extra step? First he couldn't learn, then Rabbi Akiva had to fast, then when he fasted, Hashem said, why are you bothering? Right? And then finally, it works out. Why do we add that step? And lastly, I sort of highlighted it briefly, but I want to call even more attention to it, this notion that the child in the story was not even circumcised. Right? Afilu mitzvat mila lo isaknubo. We didn't even bother to give him a bris mila. If you're looking from a halachic perspective, it's clearly the townspeople who are in the wrong here. Right? There's a hierarchy that Chazal described. If the father can't circumcise him, so we have other people, eventually the townspeople, eventually the child is even responsible to circumcise himself. But this child hasn't gotten to that point, clearly. Why is it that the townspeople are being depicted as so sort of wicked that they would punish a child for the sins of the parents? Right? Which is essentially what's being done here, this sort of vicarious punishment. I think if we look at some of the sources that Rashi and his school would have been familiar with, we can start to unpack some of these details and get a better perspective of what kind of a notion of family and the afterlife are being depicted in this tale. Let's start with source number 11. It's a Gemara from Masechet Rosh Hashanah, which describes the different classes of sinners and what happens to them in the world to come. So the Gemara says, This is on page 6, source number 11. Poshei Yisrael begufan u'poshei umot ha'olam begufan yordim legeinom v'nidonim ba'shneimasar chodesh la'chashneimasar chodesh gufan kalav v'nishmatan nisrefet v'ruach mefazartan tachat kapot rogle tzadikim. If you are a bodily sinner, Jewish or non-Jewish, your punishment is, this is an uncomfortable thing about, your punishment is you go to hell and you suffer there for 12 months and you're eventually scattered, your ashes are scattered beneath the feet of the righteous. Right? You're done. You cease to exist. What is a Poshei Yisrael begufan? Incidentally, the Gemara later on says Poshei Yisrael begufan is a Jewish man who doesn't wear tefillin. That's what it means. And anybody who's ever been, say, on Rehov Ben Yehuda in Jerusalem or other places, you've ever seen these Chabad shlichim who are trying to get everybody to put on tefillin. I've been on planes, right? Somebody sitting next to me, off of me. So they actually base it on this notion. They say that since a poshea is somebody who doesn't wear tefillin, we need to make sure everybody wears tefillin at least once, specifically to save them from this judgment. So this is the source for those for shlichim who do that. Aside, we go on to say later in that paragraph, aval haminim, this is third line from the top, v'hamasorot v'hapikorsim shekafru b'torah shekafru b'tchiyat ha'metim v'shepirshu b'darchei tzibur v'shenatnu chititam be'eretz chayim v'shechatu v'hechtiu et harabim, etc., etc. Their punishment is yordim legehinom v'nidonim ba l'dorei dorot. If you're somebody who commits these especially heinous sins, right, and we could go through in detail what all of them are, an informer, right, somebody who probably does fit that capo mentality pretty well, or somebody who is an arch-heretic, right, who causes others to sin in an especially egregious way, your punishment, according to the Gemara, is there's no hope for you. You go to punishment in the next world, and you stay there forever, right? L'dorei dorot, and you can never be redeemed. Now, the Gemara goes on to say, in the second paragraph here, what is this notion, and I glossed over it before, hanotein, sorry, I'm saying, natnu chititam be'eretz chayim, somebody who instills their fear in the land of the living. There's a pasuk from Yechezkel, actually. Shenatnu chititam be'eretz chayim. Somebody who instills their fear. What does it mean? So the Gemara says, this is the second paragraph in source number 11, Amar Rav Chista, ze parnas hametil ema yeteira al hatzibor, shelo l'shem shamayim. Somebody who instills their fear in the land of the living, who goes to hell and is punished forever with no hope of redemption, is a parnas, a communal leader, a tax collector, who instills excessive fear in the community without having good intentions. Right? Somebody who is, in the words of the story we read, somebody who favors the rich and kills the poor. The Gemara goes on to say, Amar Yehuda Amar Rav, Kol parnas hametil ema yeteira al hatzibur, shelo l'shem shamayim, eino ro'eh ben talmid chacham, is guaranteed that his son will not be righteous. His son will not be able to learn Torah. So if we look back at our story and we say, why do they choose a tax collector? Why is the son in the story unable to learn? It has to do with the fact that the story is not just being told about a generic sinner. It's being told about a specific kind of sinner. The very sinner that Chazal and the Gemara tell us is a sinner who has no hope of redemption. And the story chooses specifically that type of sinner as the archetype of somebody who can, in fact, be redeemed. Somebody who, if you were zaikadish for them, even though the Gemara says their situation is hopeless, the prayer of their family members, the intercession of their son, will actually go against the black letter law, right? Will go against what the Gemara says will happen, and will actually send them to reward in the world to come. Let's look at one more source, and then do some summary. If we go down, we're skipping a few, just in the interest of time, but if we go down to the very last source, source number 15, there's a notion in medieval Ashkenaz, and it seems to be new to medieval Ashkenaz, that children who are not circumcised will similarly be punished eternally in the world to come. Midrash Tehillim, which is a source that was collected in roughly this time period and was very influential in medieval Ashkenaz, says in the Hebrew at the top, Chaviva Hamila Shekol Mishehu Mahul Eino Yored LeGehinom. Right? Any child who is circumcised will never be punished in hell, will never go to the world to come and attain any suffering. We look back at our story, the community members specifically tell Rabbi Akiva, we didn't even bother to circumcise this child, right? This sort of notion that we are trying to cause the child to be punished for the sins of his father, right? This notion that familial relationships are a destiny in a certain sense, that you will be punished for the sins of your ancestors, and that the community is attempting to sort of reify that rule. They're attempting to take this notion that a child could be punished for the sins of their father and to inflict it on a specific child because they hated the father that much. Now, if we try to take a step back, because we're running low on time, and say, what does this story and this ritual, the recitation of Kaddish, tell us about the question that we started off with? Does family carry over into the next world or not? Is family constitutive of your identity, or is it accidental? When we look at everybody in this room, are we individuals who are responsible for ourselves and who will live or die by our own merits? Or are we members of sort of an interconnected familial web? The story that we just read, I think, very clearly indicates that family is, if not the most, then certainly one of the most crucial components of our identity. To the extent that in the next world, even the most hopeless person, even the person that our sages tell us is beyond redemption, family has the ability to break their bonds. Family has the ability to elevate them to life in the world to come. Now, what does it tell us, if we have two perspectives that I've tried to lay out for you, what does it tell us that in the 12th and 13th centuries in Ashkenaz, this is an issue that is so sort of rich and so freighted and so contested? Why is it that Sefer Chassidim has such a radical perspective on family that they say you shouldn't even kiss your children, right? Kissing your children is a theologically meaningless statement. And at the same time, we have an equally but opposite extreme reaction to say that family is so important that it'll even override the law. It'll even override the fate that people are supposed to experience if only their children will recite a prayer on their behalf. Well, since we're out of time, I can't answer that question in a lot of detail, but I will say this. What we know from historical scholarship in general is that in the 12th and 13th century, the nature of what a family was undergoing radical shifts, right? And I think we can all sort of understand this intuitively. If you look in the Tanakh, the kinds of families that are described there are not the nuclear families that we experience, right? A man marries four women and has 12 kids and they live in a, you know, mini city of their own, and that's a family, right? That was a family maybe for Yaakov Avinu, right? In 3,000 years ago, 3,500 years ago, that's what a family was. Today, a family is something very different. And that shift was part of what was going on in this time period. Anybody who's heard of Rabbeinu Gershom or Hagola, for example, whose most famous ordinance was prohibiting polygamy, saying that these kinds of extended familial networks, where one man is at the center of multiple families, is not something that Judaism is going to tolerate anymore. It's a notion that a nuclear family is coming to rise up in place of an extended kinship network. This is something that we know from historical scholarship in general was going on in this time period. And what I think we're seeing here is Jewish thinkers trying to grapple with a really significant shift that's going on. What a family means is undergoing development in their culture. And what they need to do is figure out how do traditional sources allow them to grapple with this fundamental cultural and social change. Right? We see something going on around us, we look back to our traditional sources, and we try to figure out how are we going to wrap our heads around it. For Sefer Chassidim, the answer is very radical in one direction. For Machzor Vitri, the answer is very radical in the other direction. And I don't think there's any way to bridge the gap between the two of them other than to say that they're both trying to wrap their heads around something so crucial as family, and something so crucial as theology, and their notion of what their souls are going to experience in the world to come, and they're trying to bridge the gap between the two of them. They're trying to figure out how do these two crucial constructs relate to one another. Now, for our own lives, right, I said at the beginning there's no wrong answer to the thought experiment. Maybe there's no wrong answer. When we see people who are willing to sacrifice their children because they believe the rapture is imminent, so probably many of us find that to be repellent. And yet when we look at sources from within our own tradition, we find that there are an array of perspectives on what family means. And I think, frankly, this is not me, the historian, speaking, but this is just me, the guy off the street speaking. I think there's something deeply comforting about the notion that family can be either constitutive of your identity or something that you can, if not easily, then something that is possible to rise beyond and to sort of leave behind you, right? We all know that family can be a mixed blessing sometimes for people, depending on what kinds of circumstances they're born into. Family is something that's so crucial and yet so random. And what I think we see within our tradition is that there's room both for seeing people as fundamentally part of a web of interconnection, and also seeing them as fundamentally individuals who are responsible for their own fate, individuals who will actually be able to supersede the circumstances that they're born into. And we see thinkers in this time period trying to reconcile those two, and I hope that for us today, those two perspectives both give us a sense of what the array of theological positions was, but also gives us tools for ourselves to use in terms of how we think about our own family lives and its own relationship to our Jewish lives. If anybody has questions, I'm happy to take them. Please, let's maybe work around the room. One, two, three, please. And I know we're out of time, so if anybody needs to leave, then you should also feel free to do that.
In this story with Rabbi Akiva, that the man's name himself is Akiva.
Good. So there's actually a lot in this story that I didn't get to. I think if we had 2 hours, we could not exhaust everything that's in this story. The fact that his name is Akiva, I think, is deeply significant, because a part of this whole story that we didn't have time to tell was that this is also the time period, 12th, 13th century Ashkenaz, where the notion that one names their children for their deceased relatives is coming into the fore, right? Today it's sort of commonplace. Ashkenazim name for their dead relatives, Sephardim name for their living relatives. That divide is coming to be in exactly this time period. And I think we could read the story from the perspective of what do names, and familial names in particular, tell us about the way that we think about our connections to members of our family, right? If I'm named after my grandfather, does that mean, as some thinkers tell us in this time period, that part of his soul has been implanted in my soul, right? If it does, that's a very radical statement about what family means in terms of a person's individual identity. If you believe that that's not the case, then it tells you something very different. So I think the naming piece is something that's very significant, and I think it's a part of this broader development. Thank you for pointing it out. Please.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Here's how really Akiva could have ended up, someone like this other Akiva, but of course we don't know because his wife or his family source. Anyway,
right, exactly.
But,
exactly.
I was just curious, this whole discussion of not circumcising,
mm-hmm.
I mean, historically speaking, in that time period, was there some sort of movement or fear of, because I would think in these insular type communities that would have just been a given, a child is born and circumcised.
Yeah.
Is there some sort of historical evidence that there was maybe a fear, maybe due to whatever was going on? Christian world, were they stopping to circumcise?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I don't know of any evidence, you know, the kinds of things we associate with, you know, the Maccabean, right? These persecutions of the Greeks, for example, you're not allowed to circumcise, or, you know, communist Russia or whatever. I don't know of any evidence in this time period that or San Francisco, right? Lo aleinu.
It seems to be a given to me, and here they're having this whole discussion.
The piece of evidence that I can point to is that it seems to be have been the notion that children would pass away, you know, Rahman al-Islam, without being circumcised was common enough that sources from this time period tell us that children should actually be circumcised post-mortem. Mm-hmm. And I don't know enough to know if this actually still goes on today, but I assume it does. If anybody knows, you know, somebody on a Chevra Kadisha or is part of a Chevra Kadisha. And that comes, the first written evidence for that is in exactly this time period, 13th century, Rabbeinu Gershom HaGozer, who wrote a book called Sefer HaBrit, which is a circumcision manual. And he says for the first time, if a child dies uncircumcised, you know, you circumcise them. And it's a response to this fear that a child might suffer in the world to come. And if we wanted to think about parallels, and this I'm just saying without going into detail, we could think about ideas about baptism in the Christian world, right, where a similar sort of notion exists.
Exactly.
The notion that a child would die before the day that they could be circumcised would not be at all uncommon. I saw other hands, I thought. Please.
So I'm about to say that he disputed by other sources that he's familiar with that.
Please.
I think what we don't know about the story, maybe just as important as what we do know, for example, this man's son was born after he died.
Mm-hmm.
Says, I have a son. He didn't say he's
Well, he refers to her as Ishto, but, you know, that also might be a generic... you're right. There's definitely details here that we can't fill in.
So are there other sources that support this way of thinking about it, though, that are similar without these missing details?
This way of thinking about which element in particular?
You know, that Noam Abai, you need a son or somebody to say Kaddish for you, uh-huh. and that will change your fate. You know, another story of a family like this.
Uh-huh.
So
there are earlier, this gets into sort of textual criticism, but there are versions of this story that appear in other midrashic collections, some of them that are collections that are hard to date, where the notion that there's a child and he needs to somehow redeem the father. Actually, if you look in the Gemara, there's this notion that, I think it's in Perek Chelek in Masechet Sanhedrin, which is one of the later chapters in Masechet Sanhedrin, deals with these kinds of afterlife issues. And it says, "Baram izake abba," that a child has the potential to benefit their deceased father. Right? It's one voice within this tradition in the Gemara. So there definitely are earlier antecedents that would point to this notion that there might be a connection. But what I think is unique here is the fact that a story is being crafted that has these multiple sort of layers of symbolism, which all gesture, at least I would argue, all gesture in the direction of there's a connection that lasts beyond death. And the fact that that story is being told precisely in the time period when Sefer Chasidim is putting out this very, very radically different perspective, right, to me shows that it's an issue that's being contested. I think you could probably, you know, if you looked hard enough in Chazal, as I tried to show, you could find antecedents for both of those positions. But the fact that it's being contested so vigorously and with such radically different perspectives, right, Kaddish on the one hand, never kissing your kids on the other, shows us that it's an issue that people are really trying as hard as they can to work through. Thank you. Yeah, please, Simon.
I think it has to do with the time period of the Crusades. The Duke families were grappling with the reality of, you know, I know there were different responses to the Crusades.
Yeah.
Some people, you know, killed themselves, some people converted, some people, I don't know, hid out, whatever. As families, do you think that has to do with any of this emphasis on what is a family?
So this is a great question, and I'll just... I'll put in a plug for myself, which is that I'm actually teaching a class here at Oratoria in July, and we'll spend a lot of time talking about the Crusades and the responses. But among the responses that Sima didn't list is that not only did people who were being pressured by Crusaders to convert to Christianity, not only did they kill themselves, not only did they hide out, not only did they try to escape, but they often, and this is hard to even say, but they often massacred their own families. And we have really explicit evidence, and some of it is really gut-wrenching. You read this stuff and it's hard to keep your composure, but really explicit evidence that men and women would slaughter their children and then slaughter each other so that they wouldn't be converted to Christianity. And I think it's a crucial piece of this when we're looking at what does family mean in this time period. The fact that less than... Sorry, we ended. I'm getting signals. No, I'm sorry, we ended. People are asking questions. But I can force everybody to leave it.
I just want them to have... No, of course not. I want them to have a break before they're...
100%.
And we have a room waiting in
it. Again, if anybody wants to... I'm happy to take questions, but if people want to head out, they really should not.
Can you just
feel
tell
free.
Them when that class is, maybe?
Yeah. If I remember it, I could tell you. It's going to be at Ortora on Wednesdays in July, three Wednesdays in July.
You can call the office.
The theme is medieval Ashkenaz, the history of medieval Ashkenaz. Yeah, but so the answer is, I think the fact that a few years before these sources are being written, some of these people witnessed parents massacring their own children can't help but play into this whole, you know, and the fact that they believe that by killing their children they would be sending them to life in the world to come, I think it's definitely a piece here. I think we could talk for a long time about this topic and get a lot of different issues. Yeah, please.
I'm curious because I know that this mask off of the guys,
So meaning, could we draw distinctions between, say, a spouse and a child, right? And, you know, even scientifically, we can think about maybe genetic links between people versus, you know, spousal connections, which are just by choice. I hadn't thought about it. It's a really interesting idea. I would need to think about it some more, but it might be a really good direction to think in.
On the other side of the point, the spouses are supposed to share the same neshama, two halves of the same neshama.
Yeah.
So then you think, like, well, then Krishansky is submissive, like, and everything, like, the neshama is connected. And then I even heard that Klal Yisrael is one big neshama. So, like,
So, you know, the... Right.
Very confusing.
Yeah, no, on the one hand we have this individualistic ethos, on the other hand we have Kol Yisrael Arevim Zevazeh, right? So there, I think, you know, the strategy I would suggest is we need to just look at specific thinkers and see how do they grapple with those distinctions, and often we'll find that a Kabbalist will approach it different than a philosopher, and there's sort of different people who are using the same text but trying to reconcile them in different ways.
I'm just going to thank Dr. Scheibitz.
I'm sorry to have gone over.
The next next three pieces, we have Mrs. Loebman, we have Rabbi Engel, and we have, what's the third piece in the puzzle there? Okay. Oh,